Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and it's Jazz on the Tube, and I discovered a great book. One of those serendipity things. I was up in Saratoga taking care of some business. And I saw this little bookstore, and I went in, and I went to the music section, and this thing just popped right out at me. It's called Going to Kansas City. It's by Nathan W. Pearson, Jr. It came out in 1987, so the research was probably done in the 80s. Good thing, because many of the musicians were not around a whole lot much longer than that. And this is one of the best documentations I've ever seen of a jazz scene ever. And it's my favorite way of conveying the history, which is directly from the musicians themselves. So what Pearson did was he interviewed a whole lot of people, and he divided the book up into a whole bunch of different chapters, and he organized sections of each person's interview to fit into the particular theme of a chapter. So for instance, when he was talking about chapter 7, Tom's Town, the Pendergast years, he got the quotes that were related to that particular topic and he put them in the chapter. So the book is primarily, if not entirely, it's got each chapter has an intro, but then he goes right into the quotes. So I'm going to read some from this book because it is fascinating. And we're going to focus on three artists who deserve a whole lot more attention than they have gotten. One is Eddie Durham, born in San Marcos, Texas. The other is the bass player who was Charlie Parker's mentor and practice partner in his early years. And that fellow should be known to all of us. And his name was, having trouble finding it, of course, I'm going to find it in a second. But the other person who deserves a lot more recognition in the history of jazz as it's told is Mary Lou Williams. And so we're going to hear from Mary Lou Williams. We're going to hear from Eddie Durham. And we're going to hear from Gene Ramey, the bass player who was Charlie Parker's mentor and older brother, sort of musical brother, and also his practice partner. So, first chapter, the roots of Kansas City jazz. And lately I'm finding this stuff really interesting, the music before jazz. And so the book, this chapter is broken down into Saturday night suppers and rural music making. Because we have to remember the vast majority of Americans lived in rural areas at the turn of the last century, you know, 1900. And certainly a lot of Afro-Americans lived in the countryside. So that culture of what was going on in the countryside, very important. The next section is traveling shows, minstrels, carnivals, and circuses. And let me just read a little bit from the book here. A profusion of entertainments, vaudeville companies, medicine, Wild West and minstrel shows, circuses, carnivals, and movies traveled throughout America between 1900 and 1930. You know, we just don't have that anymore. But that was the norm. That was the way it was when jazz was forming itself. That was the backdrop to everything. Traveling shows were a powerful magnet for ambitious and inquisitive musicians. The spectacles were exotic and wonderful events. The performers in them, worldly wise troubadours. For many young musicians beginning to explore their new talent, traveling shows offered the perfect opportunity for adventure and musical training. As a consequence, these shows were also a very powerful force in the musical development of America, absorbing musicians of widely different backgrounds and styles and spreading, developing new styles widely. So if you want to understand American music and you want to understand jazz, it really helps to just visualize that the early part of the last century, the 1900s, late 1800s, was dominated by traveling musicians. Remember, there was no internet, there was no television, there was no radio, and there weren't that many records. So certainly towards the end of that period there were some records, but I think in early part of this period they were just cylinders, wax cylinders. So live music was the thing and traveling shows were it. And so a lot of the great musicians that we've come to know over the years had their roots in that kind of playing. So let's hear from Eddie Durham, born October 19th, 1906 in San Marcos, Texas. Guitar, trombone, arranger, composer, performed and arranged for many jazz orchestras, including the Walter Page Blue Devils, the Benny Moten Orchestra, Count Basie Orchestra, Jimmy Lunsford, Glenn Miller, and Artie Shaw, pioneer electric guitarist. And we're always talking about Eddie Durham every chance we get because he is one of the great unsung creative heroes of jazz. So he's got a big section on the circus life. So let's go. So here's what Eddie said. My father was a fiddler. Born in Mexico, he used to play for square dances and I used to play with him. He would play his fiddle and take some of his kids along and get two hat pins. And he would play his fiddle. We're standing there playing rhythm on it, the fiddle neck, with those hat pins. That fiddle would sound like a drum. And what a rhythm it was. He'd kill two or three rattlesnakes, and he'd get the rattles and dry them out and put them in the fiddle. And the rattles would amplify the fiddle. This was about 70 miles south of San Antone, a place they call San Marcos. I could read music because my brother studied music. He joined the Army, which another great way to learn music in those days and even today, which was the 24th Infantry Division, the Rough Riders. So I used to go out to Mexico where he was stationed on the border. He'd get me a place in town and he would teach me some music. He started teaching me trombone and guitar, and I could read. You have to have a gun where I was living out there for rattlesnakes and wild animals. They used to wear them to town when I was a little boy. I used to go to the theater, and the guy would have movies once a week, silent movies, and a guy would be choking a woman. A guy would say, "Charlie, you ain't going to let that polecat choke that woman," and he'd shoot up the man's screen. The cops would come in, but every week he'd shoot up the man's screen. So if I'm understanding this correctly, movies were so new to this part of Texas that audience members would get upset when they would see certain things on the screen and they would actually pull out their six shooters and start shooting the screen. Anyway, different times. I got a guitar from some guy in Greensville, Texas, and I went away for a show called Doug Martin's Dramatists. That's where I learned guitar. It was a tent show, a regular stage show. They had classics and everything. It was a white show, but they had a minstrel show with them too. All the circuses had a sideshow called the minstrel show. Now, for people that are easily offended, that's the way it was back then, folks. And just, you know, that's what was going on. The minstrel show would always consist of about a 9-piece band that could play jazz or swing or whatever you call it. And they'd use tunes like Alabama Bound. When the curtain would rise, they'd have all them big striped hats on, and the guys would be sitting there, about 6 or 7 guys. There would be a dancing team and a comedian way over in the corner sitting down. One of them would start laughing, and the crowd would just break up. I know a guy was called Porkchop, and one was named Lassus Brown. Boy, they cracked some of the funniest jokes. They had the white gloves, and one had big red lips, and the other one would have big white lips. If they ever put me off a show, it would be for laughing at those comedians. Those guys were good in those days. I was later with the Georgia Minstrel and Alabama Minstrel and some shows like that. So this was a big source of employment. I got started in arranging when I decided to go with the Miller Brothers 101 Wild West Circus. I was the youngest guy on the show. It was larger than Ringling Brothers because it had three or four tribes of Indians, just like in the movies. In one scene, four or five covered wagons would come out with a lot of people. 15 Indians would come out on horses, you know, shoot them, burn up the wagons. Those Indians would fall off the horses, but they had hay all around out there. They had two big bands, a big white band and a black band. The black band was the jazz band because they had a minstrel show over there. The black band was a small band, but they still had three trombones and trumpets and all that. The shows closed early, around 10 o'clock at night, and we'd give a dance from 10 to 1, something like that. Yeah, 50 cents to come in, or a quarter, and the town would come down. I'd get the guys to rehearse, and those old guys could play. That's how I started writing. But it was all for me to learn harmony, because if I made any bad notes, they would break away until I straightened up. That's how I learned to voice. So much vocal and five-part harmony because I had to play around and experiment with those horns. So he didn't get to go to the new school for jazz studies, but he was able to get an education nonetheless. I stayed with the 101 maybe a year. We played all over, Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, all out west. I wrote some numbers. By the way, notice all these places. We're not talking about Chicago or New Orleans or New York City or even St. Louis, all out west. Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, all out west. I wrote some numbers like they had slide trombones, a whole family of trombone songs, Parson trombone, Sally trombone. The band stopped when you're marching and the trombones would play all that stuff. I was a fancy guy. I'd make a jazz break. One of those Johnny Dunn breaks, and those guys framed up on me. I don't know what any of this means. When we're marching to the park, when everybody cuts out, all the trombones were going to take out. They had it all framed up with the leader to see whether I was going to play the part, you know. Finally, I learned it. I waited for them to take down on it, and I made a jazz break. Man, it was a jazz break, and the public was all over the street. That's how I got the band with me. They thought I knew something. We played Yankee Stadium, and they left, went to Europe. I was afraid of boats and everything else. That's when I left. But I had my degree anyway. I graduated from Street University, and it only took him 1 year. Remarkable. Remarkable. So that's the roots of Kansas City jazz. Now, bio on Gene Ramey. Born April 4th, 1913, Austin, Texas. Died 1984 in Austin. String bass. Active in many bands, including Oliver Todd, Jay McShann, Ben Webster, Coleman Hawkins, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, Lester Young, Count Basie. Featured on many recordings. His comment, in those days, everywhere you looked, there was bands. There must have been 8 or 10 bands in San Antonio, and we knew 4 or 5 in Houston. There must have been 20 bands in Dallas and Fort Worth. At one time, there must have been 15 or 20 bands in Omaha. So the bands, they spread out all over. That tour from Kansas City would usually take you down through Arkansas and Louisiana, over to Texas, back up through Oklahoma. They had almost a regular circuit. Almost every week you could find a different band in Austin. We played in these old ballrooms. In those days, bands were really loud. The amazing thing about it is the bands were so loud, yet still the singers didn't have microphones. They had to sing through that megaphone. The booking agents would start in January to find themselves an ensemble that would go to some of the resorts, either in the Ozarks or up in Saskatchewan or in other parts of Canada, British Columbia, you know. There was usually plenty of work in the summertime, but Kansas City was year-round. There was always plenty of music, and this comes from the chapter of the territories. And I learned recently what that means. It means that you'd have a radio station, and the radio station would have a house band, and the house band would do gigs within the listening nexus of the radio station's signal. So that was a territory. Okay, back to Eddie Durham, still talking about the territories. I went to Kansas City around 1925. I must have gotten stranded there with somebody. When I was there, I joined a band. We formed a brass section, which was Eddie Compton and Paul Webster and me. Eddie Compton was a crazy guy, too. He was working on the side for a mortician. But the guy would always say, I leave him here to close up, and when I come back the next day, he picks the highest price casket I've got, and when I come back, he's laying in there asleep. We also had Bud Johnson's brother, Keg Johnson, then Bud Johnson, Booker Pittman. We had five. I think Herschel Evans was with us at that time. So Jess Stone organized a band, and we went with Jess. We didn't stay very long, but we went over with Jess, the entire group. Next section. Mary Lou Williams. Born May 8, 1910, Atlanta, Georgia. Died May 28, 1981, Durham, North Carolina. Piano and arranger. Learned to play in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and began performing professionally at age 4. Went on the road as a pianist in 1925, married saxophonist John Williams in 1927, became pianist for the 12 Clouds of Joy in 29, immediately achieved prominence, recognized as being among the outstanding pianists and arrangers in jazz history, and among the pioneer modern jazz stylists, active as a performer and teacher until her death in 1981. My husband, John Williams, Andy Kirk hired him. They were in Oklahoma then, playing all the territory. Now, confusion here. Here she's talking about the state of Oklahoma, which in those days was the Oklahoma Territory. But it's amazing how much great jazz was in Oklahoma and Texas. I don't know that we have a grasp of that here in the East or even in New Orleans. They got a job in Kansas City, and they decided to make their headquarters there. I used to sit and jam and travel with the band, but they had their own pianist. I did this until we reached Philadelphia, and something happened to him. And I jumped on the Steinway and played. The owner of the theater said to Andy Kirk, you don't need that man, just take that little girl. That's how I got the job. I guess I was 16 or 17. Andy Kirk's band had the greatest readers. At one time, most of the musicians didn't read, and Andy Kirk had terrific readers in his band. We'd pull out an arrangement and play it on the job without rehearsing it. Good Lord. We never had any that couldn't really read. They spelled, which means they were slower than the good readers. The musicians who couldn't read made better improvisational musicians. It's interesting. They had nothing to stop them. They could do it without thinking about reading notes. I used to have crazy ideas and never write them down. Andy Kirk used to come to the house at 11 o'clock in the morning. He'd stay until 12 or 1 at night. And I had arranged two things for the band to come back that night because I was sick of sitting there 12 hours. The only thing was wrong, I think, was the trombone and tenor. So he showed me how to voice them. And I started arranging them from that day on. During that period, you had three saxophones. I needed a fourth because we were doing bigger parts. So I used a trumpet man blowing in a hat so that he would sound like a saxophone. Andy Kirk's band played for everything. They played for proms and dances. We played everything. and then we'd come back swinging like Count Basie. We'd play sweet music until 12 o'clock, then everybody'd start playing. They were afraid of losing the dancers. So I guess the sweet music was for the dancers, and then at midnight, they played the real stuff. Okay. That's from our great hero of jazz, Mary Lou Williams. And now we're going to read The Road Leads to Kansas City, and here's Eddie Durham. Times were hard, and all the guys got that far, and they couldn't get no further. That's the real truth. The Depression had a really catastrophic effect on the music and recording industry. I mean, really catastrophic. And so a lot of musicians ended up stranded. There wasn't any band sending for them, so they just ended up in Kansas City because they could live. If I could go somewhere, if I could go stay somewhere, I wasn't going to pay. Nobody ever bothered you about money in those days. Everything was handy, generous. I think that had a lot to do with it. I know that's as far as I got. Basie got stranded in Kansas City, too. Kansas City musicians thought they were the greatest. They formed a clique out there. Anybody ever hit town, we'd get right out there. They used to jam at 4 o'clock in the morning. Boy, that's the way the town was. The jam sessions went on all night and all day. I remember one night there was Ben Webster, Coleman Hawkins, and it must have been Don Byas. They had a battle of tenor saxophones. I think they started at 8 o'clock, and they finished at 8 o'clock the next morning. They used about 5 or 6 piano players. One guy would go home and sleep, and they'd call up the next guy. This guy would make it a half hour, hour. That went on and on. It was going on at the Subway Club. That was the main place. A 12-hour jazz session. Jam session. Gene Ramey. Everyone was trying to make it to Kansas City. Kansas City then was kind of a focal point for people to go for an urban center in those days. That was like the first stop. The next stop, if they made it, was to Chicago. Some of them wanted to go to St. Louis, but it was Kansas City most of all because this was it. And it became most famous, and mostly through musicians traveling. Every time they would come into town, they would say, when you come to Kansas City, just like an invitation, they had a regular Goodwill Bassett ambassador going around. Okay. All roads lead to Kansas City. Next chapter, The Wide Open Town. Back to Eddie Durham. It's a gangster town, and they was hiding all the gangsters. I met Pretty Boy Floyd there, and I saw Babyface Nelson. Saw Floyd about 4 days before he got killed, and because he came in the Cherry Blossom. He was playing pool, and he come around to hear the bands. Finally, police came in and told him to get out of there because the police are looking for you, the feds. So one branch of the police department tipped off Babyface Nelson against another branch of the police department. I played one place. A mobster come in with his big white hat on and his 4 bodyguards. The boss come in and said, all right, Johnny, check the hardware. These guys would take a machine gun, all the guns, lay them on the piano. They had it pretty well controlled. Only thing was, one particular night, some fight started. Not between the gangs, something else. I left the club, jumped out the window, and went home about 1 o'clock. 3 o'clock, knocking on the wood, was the trigger man. Come on. He wants you back there. Got in the car. Felt good. Nothing's going to happen to you. I got a friend. Because you couldn't quit one job and go to another. We worked for one guy. This is Eddie Durham. Those guys paid you double for anything you ever done in Kansas City. They never owed a musician a nickel. Boy, that's pretty rare. The gangsters always protected. The gangsters would always treat everybody right. If you touched a musician or one of the girls, you'd go out on your head. Nobody ever harassed musicians. So, Kansas City. Mary Lou Williams, about the wide open town. We used to go to Piney Brown's place on 12th Street with Count Basie. He used to play, and there was a little bench. Everyone used to sit on the bench, and whoever was next, they'd go and play. And they just loved it. He'd give us money. He was very kind to the musicians. So if you want great music, be kind to your musicians. Okay, Eddie Durham, talking about the wide open town. The clubs were very risque. Like, we'd have girls dancing. One girl would get nude and pick up the money. The guys would lay the money up there to see her pick it up. She'd do an hour, then the next hour she'd go into another gangster club. So it wasn't all just music. Mary Lou Williams, Kansas City was such a great city for the music. When anyone visited, they always stayed. They never left. That's where I met Thelonious Monk and Joe Smith, the great trumpet player. Fletcher Henderson stayed there and married a girl. It was just so joyous to go out every night around 7 o'clock and jam and play the piano and mingle with people all through the morning. Anybody that came through town, they'd come and get me. If I was home and somebody was in the city, Ben Webster or somebody would come and scratch on the window and say, come on out, everybody's jamming. And I'd get up and go out with them. There were just thousands of clubs. I'd never seen so many clubs in all my life. On 12th Street, there must have been 50. They were clean clubs, but not anything classy. So that music came out of the music we see came out of a really abundant, fertile place. Kansas City jazz style, Mary Lou Williams. The Kansas City jazz style was a swinging left hand. If a pianist didn't have a strong left hand, well, he was not considered very good at all. Nobody would play with him. They had quite a number of good piano players. Now, Gene Ramey said this, let me give you my definition, all the forms of jazz. New Orleans, which is the original jazz, you know, was built off marching band, parade band music. The drums swung the band. Boy, ain't that the truth. You go to Chicago-style jazz, which was the same thing, but they put a little organization in the front line. In other words, the three horns, instead of just going for themselves, they would play little arrangement. Some little arrangement. One guy played the lead, another guy played the tenor, another played the alto, but they played organized. Now, if you remember my interview with Vic Hobson, and if you don't know it, you should look it up. Keep in mind that Louis Armstrong, before he picked up a cornet, before he went to the Waves home, he was a boy singer in a quartet, and he said they had the best quartet in all of New Orleans. So when you talk about the Chicago style, when Gene talks about the Chicago style, maybe that had some influence on it. Now here's an interesting part. Now comes Kansas City, which is like an old-time revival, like an old camp meeting. You hear the people shouting. You hear that in Basie's band, you know. It's just a happy-go-lucky thing. The trumpets are going one way, the saxophones another way. The trombones are still going a different way, and that rhythm section is just straight ahead. With the Kansas City band, the rhythm section is supposed to be free. For example, in the Basie band, the rhythm section never read the music after the first time. That's why Basie's band always had been famous and still sounds the same. The rhythm section is not harnessed. And don't forget, the rhythm section is the food of the band. There never was a band that was great unless it had a great rhythm section. Got some profound stuff coming down here. The rhythm section has to sound together. In those days, they didn't have an amplifier for a piano or for a guitar. The drums were the loudest one in there. Now, all four of us got to play. And we've got to play so that the loudest instrument is no louder than the softest instrument. The drummer's foot was never supposed to be so loud. It's called a Bigfoot drummer. Anybody could go crazy after a while, you know, jump out of windows. I don't know what he's talking about there. The Kansas City rhythm sections got it together. He goes on. Gene Ramey goes on. We don't need any written music. What we play is on a riff. Kansas City jazz is supposed to be more freedom. But you didn't get too far with the solos. When the McShann Band went to New York, we had the first chorus and the last chorus written. All in between was nothing but riffs. It was the same with the Basie Band. You're getting more to the people because you're going to play those little simple things that they can understand. The rhythm section's got to be swinging. The less piano you play and the more room you give the bass to walk, the guitar player to play his chords, the better off you are. That's why Basie's just swinging. He stays out of the way. Profound. We'd have a jam session. This guy sets a riff over here, and this one sets a riff over there, and another one sets up a riff, and the guys just go on swinging. Each chorus, they build it up. Kansas City jazz. His next statement, Gene Ramey, even to this day, I can tell you that Kansas City is the only place where the musician wants to battle each other with all the guns blazing. Mary Lou Williams, in a jam session, we'd improvise. Somebody'd say, let's play George Brown. You'd improvise, and I've heard arrangements that were sensational. An arranger couldn't do as good. So the improvised arrangements were sensational. That's the type of band that Count Basie had. You see, there's an awful lot of love in the music. There was quite a bit of love in Kansas City. That's what made it so wonderful. Okay, chapter on Betty Moten. Eddie Durham speaking. Betty Moten was the king. He was the king all out. Only person maybe who could play with him would be guys like Duke Ellington. He didn't ever battle with those guys because he was his own promoter. It was a Commonwealth band. Everybody got the same money, leaders and all. Benny had a funny kind of swing. I don't know what you'd call it back in those days. Was it no Dixieland? Those guys had a funny style that no one else played much. I often think about this tenor guy, Woody Walder, who was in Benny Moten's band. No other tenor player in the world ever sounded like that guy. He could swing that stuff. It was commercial the way he would do it, enough so you could keep up with him. And that was Eddie Durham. More from Eddie Durham. Benny Moten was one of the greatest leaders that ever was. He just knew what to do and how to treat the men, everything like that, and he was the same with the men exactly 100%. I had a voice individual harmony up to 6 parts when I went in the band, but they were using 3. They could read, but you had to coach them on how to make a true tone. I made the band's theme Moten Swing in the theater. We needed it for a show in Philadelphia. We took a lot of encores, so the band said, you got to get some more songs because we're playing the same things over and over. So I took off and went downstairs to make Moten Swing. I based it on You're Driving Me Crazy because we had an arrangement. Basie came down and started it, but then got out of there. When he came back, he said, go ahead, use this line from Driving Me Crazy because he wanted to play that. Then when the band played, he took that line because he wasn't sure the chord I run the other stuff against. He knew the melody all right. He helped create that. Gene Ramey, on the Count Basie Orchestra. Lester Young and Herschel Evans were playing with Basie when I first came to Kansas City. They were playing with Benny Moten's band when they broke off into two sections. That was in 33. They were each trying to form a band. Basie took a little band and got stranded in Little Rock, Arkansas. Buddy Tate was living down there. Buddy kind of helped to feed them and sit with the band on a couple of dates, something like that. This was the usual routine for musicians in those days to get stranded. Bands in those days tried to spread out all over, but the Basie band came back to Kansas City to get back with Benny Moten. When they came back, they were just hustling around town. Now, it was during this time that Basie had patches in his pants and holes in his shoes, and you could see him walk down the street trying to be a dignified beggar. So we know these guys as glamorous superstars of jazz, and we don't have a clue what they went through just to survive and to get through to the other side. Eddie Durham, this is so interesting. Count Basie's got some fantastic ideas, but nobody's ever got them out of him. He would never sit still long enough for you to get them. He'd always give me an idea for a couple of measures. Then he'd find a little girl and go out and drink or do something else in order to be gone. And I'd have to build from that. I could never tie him down. People don't know he had a talent like that today. He smothered it because you could never get him to do anything. That's really interesting. That's from Eddie Durham about Count Basie. Okay, Eddie Durham again. When I went back to Basie in 37, he was in New York engaged in playing the park. I arrived that Monday morning, but when I took the train in, Ben Bolt, the manager, said, get enough sleep. Better sleep all night. I'll bet you $50 you'll have a song when you get here, arranged for the band. Sure enough, I got there, and I got some sort of tune, slightly Latin, and I just took my guitar and played it low. When I got there that morning with Basie's band, Buck Clayton was in the band, Harry Edison, those kind of fellows, so they had a rehearsal at 12 o'clock. I had the thing about half finished, no score, just the parts. I said, anybody want to help me copy some parts? Everybody just stood there. I went out in the park, and that's how they got Topsy, which was among Basie's first recordings and a major hit. That's the first tune they put in the book. How do you like that? The story of Topsy, I never knew that. Okay. The J. McShann Orchestra, Gene Ramey speaking. We, the rhythm section, piano, bass, drums, guitar, were known as the 20th century rhythm section. In those days, Charlie Parker wasn't known, and the band was featured as a rhythm band. In the Kansas City style, the drummer's foot was never supposed to be so loud. The rhythm drummer with the McShann band was Gus Johnson. We had it arranged. I played along with the saxophones. The drummer played the dynamics with the trumpet. Gene was a bass player, so he went with the saxophones, and the drummer went with the trumpet. So that brings out what the trumpet players are playing. McShann made an important addition to the band while on tour in Texas. Al Hibbler, a blind singer who was later featured with Duke Ellington. Okay. Little fine points. It's all in the fine points. Gene Ramey again. Lucky Millinder's band sent us a note saying, we're going to send you Hicks to the sticks. And boy, we didn't want to go back to Kansas City. We had dreams and everything. So we planned on taping the piano keys. So when the guy sits down to play, nothing would happen. We thought of all these kinds of things. We were going to put tacks on the guy's seats. Then the guy said, no, these cats might be bigger and badder than we are, but then we're going to have to run. Pretty competitive. That McShann band, every band that we caught, we'd blow them out. So the McShann band was pretty good. So they wouldn't ever let us play against Basie or Lionel Hampton. competitive. So it's an intensely, intensely competitive arena, almost like boxing. You know, where certain boxers, you know, don't want to face certain challengers. We were the, this is Gene Ramey speaking, we were known as the swingingest rhythm section. The Jay McShann rhythm section, even outplaying Basie. I think the reason is we played more fast tunes. When we went to New York, all we had written was the first chorus and the last chorus, and the rest of that was nothing but riffs. Our first broadcast in New York, we started playing Cherokee. It was supposed to have been a 15-minute broadcast, and the man heard it and said, "Who is that saxophone player? Let him play." That's Charlie Parker. We played 45 minutes instead of the 15-minute broadcast. Now, can you imagine what the old bass player was feeling like? That's him. Must have been exciting. Okay, now, Charlie Parker speaking. And I'm reading from the book Going to Kansas City by Nathan W. Pearson, Jr. And it is a great jazz history because 90% of the book is the musicians telling their own stories, and it is packed with amazing photographs. You really get a feeling for what the pre-jazz world was like and Kansas City was like and the territory bands were like. It's just good stuff, right? So what did Charlie Parker have to say? Bebop is what I brought from Kansas City. What I play, I learned in my mother's woodshed back home. Literally, his mother had a woodshed, and that's where he practiced. And that's where he developed what we hear in his mother's woodshed. Gene Ramey. Generally speaking, the Kansas City jazz you played with freedom, but you didn't go too far with the solos. When they used to come on the air, the Count Basie's radio broadcast from the Reno Club, and Prez, Lester Young, was starting to blow, he was so definite, so swinging, that everybody was trying to get home to hear that radio program. I used to call him up the next day and say, "Man, I think you come out with a new note or something." He was the first that started what they later called bebop. Then it was called running out the key. You had no key signature. You would probably start out playing in the key of B, but he might wind up playing in the key of F, just running his cycles. So now, this is what Bird and I started doing. The two of us used to practice that. I found that this was the only thing that I could do to keep him from using the thing, heroin. I'd get his eye. I'd say, "Man, let's go somewhere and jam." He'd forget about it, the heroin, right away. I didn't have any ideas for him, but it was just enough to get him away, and we'd jam day and night. There was a guitar player. His name was, I've never seen this name before, Effigy Ware. He had been with Harlan Leonard's band for a while, but he would show us how the cycles would work and how there's no such thing as a bad note. And if you know how to get out of that hole, you know. We would sit down and try that. All I did was just play the straight rhythm, straight chords, and let him, Charlie, go wherever he wanted to. So as long as he got back home to the original chord and key signature in time, Effigy might have gotten his stuff from some of those teachers like Jack Washington, baritone and alto sax player for Benny Moten, Jess Stone, and Count Basie. But there was another great man in Kansas City named N. Clark Smith. And all those guys over there in Kansas City went to school under him. So, wow, we just heard, I never heard this. I knew that Gene Ramey and Troy Parker were practice partners, but I had no idea what those practice sessions were like. And I had no idea that they were compelling enough to lure young Charlie Parker away from his already developed heroin habit. And I had no idea that there was a guy named Effigy Ware. I mean, I'm not a jazz scholar, but I never heard that name before, who actually taught Charlie Parker and Gene Ramey the theory that made bebop possible. And now here's another guy, N. Clark Smith, never heard of him. And what Ramey's saying is that in Kansas City, everybody studied theory with him. Oh, the history. It's, you know, it's richer and more profound than we could ever imagine. All right, so next section, Eddie Durham talking about Lester Young. Lester, in his early career, never stayed with a band. They didn't keep him because they were all looking for the tenor tone, and he didn't fit good. The tone was kind of sharp all the time. So in Basie's band, I'd use his horn to advantage. I laid him next to those alto saxophones. Could never get him on the bottom and keep him laying right between the tenor and the second alto. That's what the C melody saxophone used to be for, and that made the reed section balance out. He sounded more like the altos than he did the tenors, and that left the tenor a good opening. Jack Washington was on that baritone saxophone, and it worked out fine. Lester was a good balance, and if you're going to keep playing sharp, I'd find a way to play a chorus and start a note sharp. Damn. So it's so interesting that, you know, so Lester Young had troubles because of his tone. You know, if you're supposed to blend in and your tone's different, you're not going to blend in. So he was kind of going from band to band, kind of a little bit similar to what Charlie Parker went through, definitely what Ornette Coleman went through. So it's very interesting. Also interesting is that Lester Young was a great fan of Frank Trumbauer, like a huge fan. And Trumbauer played the C melody saxophone. And so when Durham was writing for Lester Young in Count Basie's band, he put all these conditions into play. You know, Lester wanted to play in a certain register, and he happened to play sharp. So Eddie Durham wrote stuff where Lester could fit in. So, you know, I'm just such an over-the-top fan of Eddie Durham. Modernized trombone playing, pioneer of the electric guitar, first guy to write six-part arrangements for jazz, is believed to have written the arrangement for In the Mood, and here he is making life comfortable for a young Lester Young. Okay, now Gene Ramey again. We had a little band called Oliver Todd and his Hot Ten Tots, and that's when I first met Bird. This is a Kansas City, Kansas band, and we had a battle with Bird's band, a Missouri band. He was all high school kids. We was all high school kids, except me. And I think Bird was 14 years old. He couldn't play and was mad about it, too. In that respect, he was just an evil, spoiled kid. You'd go over to Bird and say, "Hey, Bird, how you doing?" He might call you all kinds of them names. When we had started rehearsing and practicing every day, he went into that jam session with Basie and them, and they rang the bell on him. He was utterly disgusted. "Those guys can't do nothing like this to me," he said. He felt that if he did make a mistake, it was all right and he could blow as long as he wanted to, but they stopped him. They wouldn't call you aside and show you where you did wrong, but they would stop you if you were messing up the whole jam session. So Charlie Parker, 14 years old. And this is Gene Ramey's first encounter with him. When Basie went to New York and made those first Jones and Smith records, the first recordings of the Basie band in October 36, that's all he needed. He took the records and he went into the country with George E. Lee's band to gain experience and improve his skills. He's talking about Charlie Parker. He took Charlie Parker took the recordings that Count Basie made under the name Jones and Smith. I think that was for some copyright thing. And that's what became his textbook. And I forget where he went, but he went to some resort to wash dishes, I think. And he just worked on those records. And he learned all of Lester Young's parts by heart. Great learning for him. And last quote. Oh, maybe not. Mary Lou Williams. Charlie Parker was such a giant. He probably listened to a lot of people. Bud Powell was at my house every day. Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk to write music in New York in the 40s and 50s. It was maybe 8 or 9 of them. Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Tad Dameron, Klook, Kenny Clark, Oscar Pettiford, and a drummer used to play with Billy Taylor, J.J. Johnson. He changed the trombone. It was about 10 of them. I'd play with them, but mostly they'd write a tune, come to my house, like Ruby, My Dear, and things, round about midnight. I'd say, no, don't phrase it like that. Do it like this. I got off my job at 4 o'clock in the morning. We met outside the door. Maybe I'd go to Birdland or someplace and pick them up. I'd go home, buy food for the Frigidaire. I learned so many dishes to cook to put everything together, and we used to play and jam. Ideas were flowing, and maybe somebody go over to the piano and start playing. We never asked him to play anything. Wow. This book is, you get the feeling this book is full of gems. So we learned what Count Basie was like as a young man in Kansas City. We learned how the great arranger, player Eddie Durham wrote pieces so that Lester Young could have a home, a steady musical gig. We learned about how Charlie Parker actually practiced and learned what he learned and who influenced him. And now we're hearing about the incredible living room of Mary Lou Williams. Some people are aware of it. Too many jazz fans are not. Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Tad Dameron, Kenny Clark, Oscar Pettiford, J.J. Johnson would all go to Mary Lou Williams to get her input into their tunes. So, pretty amazing. The book is called Going to Kansas City. It's written by Nathan W. Pearson. It came out in 1987. I do see there's some copies floating around out there on cyberspace, so you can actually get them. And if you're willing to go with a used copy, not too bad in terms of price. This is a great piece of work. I'm glad Mr. Pearson did it, because clearly in 2019 there's no way to gather these histories anymore. They are lost, but they're not lost because he gathered them. So if you want to get a real feel for, you know, what the music was like, what the culture was like before jazz as we knew it crystallized, that's in this book. If you want to hear about one of the great jazz cities of America, one that may be the most important in some ways for modern jazz, you get a great picture of Kansas City. If you want to see what the early careers were like of people like Count Basie and Lester Young and Charlie Parker, that's all in this book. Going to Kansas City, Nathan W. Pearson, and I'm Ken McCarthy, and this has been Jazz on the Tube. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.